Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we're going to talk about woodchucks and old Louisville gardens.
We are.
Finally.
I bet you there's woodchucks in old Louisville.
I bet there are too.
I would imagine there's many a old porch in old Louisville that has a groundhog happily living.
Waiting for its shadow to appear.
That's
so
right.
It can predict winter.
Eating little pieces of greenery here and there during the day.
Actually, it's kind of a fun story. I never thought we'd speak finally of woodchucks, but here's the chance.
I'm kind of warming up to them,
Even though they're digging a hole in your dam.
Well, that's why Laura Simon is going to be a fabulous resource.
Okay.
Because I'm not one to, like, shoot an animal that isn't doing anything. I mean, I'm not one to shoot an animal even if it is doing something. But how to humanely deter a woodchuck.
We can safely say it's your damn woodchuck in this show.
It is my damn woodchuck.
Get away with
that. Because we know that there has been one living in my barn for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But in the side of the dam, it's a little bit more problematic because it might make the dam leak. And then the lake will leak out and that will be really bad. So we would like to deter this woodchuck from living in the side of the dam. And Laura Simon with the Humane Society of the United States, where they do promote humane interactions between people and animals, has some great ideas as to making an environment unpleasant for a groundhog to live in.
So it'll run over to your neighbor's yard.
Which is fine. But it needs to go a little bit further because my neighbor also owns the other side of the dam.
I know what I mean. So there's still a problematic here, but it's a good tale.
Exactly. So Laura Simon coming up on Homegrown today, and then Bob and I are going to hit the road, and we're going to tour around two gardens in Old Louisville, inspired by the Old Louisville Secret Treasures garden tour earlier in July.
One especially is nice. We discussed it because it's the Kiesling family. And it's a family garden.
It's
mom and dad and son, and they kind of cooperate in this thing, and makes a nice tale.
And there's a strong sense of commitment to old Louisville, really, in both of these stories, I think. And for the Kieslings, it's partly the historic nature of where they live. When we were speaking to them before, Bruce had talked about how this particular block, there's only two houses left on that block. And that whole street used to be lined with homes that have been torn down because of, manufacturing and stuff that's around there.
Right.
But that street was where many African-American families lived that were, in fact, in the earlier days, the service staff for some of the big houses in Old Louisville. And he feels like it's extremely important to make sure that that part of Old Louisville isn't completely torn down and that history, remains viable. So it's an interesting, some folks that are really conscious of their history. I don't know. It's really cool.
It's nice. Yeah, the other house, the people, Howard Rosenberg and Gina Blythe, they love New Orleans, so they brought it back with them.
Yeah.
Both inside their house and in their backyard.
Mm-hmm. So it's pretty cool. Great. Two good examples of what you can do with some small urban spaces, make them useful, beautiful, and historically significant, I think, preserving some of that. So hope that you'll stay with us. That's coming up in part two of Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
My dwarf dahlias.
Yeah.
And I know you are not happy with people who shop box stores. But I will shop box stores and find dahlias are chucking out because they're done blooming. And I take them home and I plant them and I cut them back. And the little guys, they will bloom for months.
Uh-huh.
And they're kicking in here in mid to late summer. The little bitty ones, when you need just, confetti of color, I call it, what you get from little dahlias. I love those things. And they're really filling in the holes where other things are kind of fading away on me. I love those things. And the spider plants are coming back. The cleomies, the purples and the pinks and the whites.
Spider flower,
Yeah, spider flowers.
Yeah.
And I like those too. They reseed around. They reseed too heavily sometimes.
Yeah, you got to let them. You got to control the. Yeah.
But still, again, it's a nice filler plant for late summer, and they're easy to do. They just keep reseeding every year, and they come back and come back. And
the hardest thing is thinning them.
Yeah, but it's worth it.
Cool.
The Wishy Estate. What's up?
I got bad news.
Oh no.
Bad news.
You don't look happy either.
I lost one of my pullets. One of my young girls.
Oh no.
One of the Golden Lace Wine Dots.
There's a story here.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. When you lose them, you never really know. We only knew that once, the very first time it happened, we only knew the story because Georgie and Eric were there and they saw it.
Yeah.
But all the other times, we just sort of had to guess. So, and I've been keeping it. I'm not being irresponsible, people.
I know.
It was one of those days that it rained all day long. I left to have lunch with a friend, and I kept the chickens. You know how we have them all rigged up now? I can let them out of the coop, but they can be in the barn.
I know.
And then they got their chicken yard. The young ones have decided now that they just jump over the little gate there.
Just like a young one.
Yeah. So I come home and to let the rest of them out, and a couple of the young ones are out, running around. But I didn't do a head count or anything like that.
I went
back in because I was hanging out with Georgie, my niece, and so then later, Georgie's walking around, and she finds, because she likes to go visit the chickens, and she holds Lily, the one that, you know, was picked on, and she finds this little pile of
feathers.
Feathers.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and not just feathers like, ooh, I'm scared I dropped some feathers. Some, like, you know, parts, but not any, like, parts. So clearly something got...
Yep.
One of the Wyandottes, and everybody else was okay. But again, it's a mystery. You don't know. It was during the day, likely a domestic dog. Typically, you don't have wild animals running around. Plus, it was raining all day, and usually you don't have a lot of stuff running around either. So there's on the small side on, like, the Plymouth Rocks.
Yep.
So, I mean, maybe even a hawk could have picked them up. I mean, I don't know. But the fact that it was raining all day, a lot of stuff doesn't
Hard
run
to figure.
Around a lot. So anyway, I don't know, but it's... It is what it is, right?
Yep. Have you buried it and put a little memorial placard or anything?
No, there's nothing there except a couple of feathers.
Okay.
I mean, that's the thing. So at least if you're going to take it, eat her and don't waste her. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and then the raccoon. It wasn't a raccoon because they wouldn't be able to catch up with one of those little things. But I had another raccoon get into some like fish-based, some seaside stuff that I've got.
Yeah.
Totally ripped open the plastic container.
Fertilizer.
It's a natural fungicide.
Yeah.
It's all over the garage floor. So now it smells like a fish processing place in my garage. So people, I'm warning you, if you have fish-based fertilizers, fish emulsion, etc., put it under lock and key or the raccoons will get to it at night.
Raccoons and roaches will own this world before we're done. Another few hundred million years, be nothing but raccoons and roaches.
I'm really happy for your dahlias, man, but it's looking grim on my side.
Well, I'll loan you a dahlia.
It'll surely turn around.
Raccoons don't eat dahlias.
No, they don't.
You'll be okay.
All right. Actually, we need to get a hold of Laura Simon and her folks there at the Humane Society of the United States to have a discussion about raccoons at some point. But for today, our discussion centers around the woodchuck. Laura Simon is joining us. She's an urban wildlife program field director at the Connecticut office with the Humane Society of the United States, where they advocate, educate, and provide hands-on programs that support the humane treatment of animals, including the groundhog in the garden. Laura, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sure. First, I just got to make sure that this is, you know, clear. A woodchuck is a groundhog, right?
They are one and the same, absolutely.
So thus the if a woodchuck could chuck wood sort of thing, because groundhogs don't really chuck wood, do they?
They don't really, but it's a fun image, so we go along with it.
All right. Just wanted to make sure that I was thinking about the same critter, because in fact I do have a couple of woodchucks that I might have to chuck off the farm.
Where'd the woodchuck name come from?
Well, I'm not exactly sure where it came from. Actually, the earlier name for them was whistle pig, because of the sound they make when they're alarmed.
Yeah.
And so that was really the earliest name that they were given. Wow. And I don't know exactly where woodchuck and groundhog came from since then.
So they're 0 for 3 in good names at this stage of the game.
Yeah, no kidding. I think that groundhog is self-explanatory.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so let's talk about the habits of your average woodchuck. Mm-hmm. Where would one find them? What kinds of things do they do, you know, during the day, at night?
Most people tend to find them in their yards, under sheds. What they create is a shallow burrow system, mm-hmm. and usually they have one main opening and maybe one or two other side exits.
Okay.
And they create this burrow system where they spend a lot of their time and where they rear their young. And generally, you'll find them out and about in yards during the day because they are complete vegetarians, and they eat herbs and all kinds of things in your lawn.
And my green beans.
And they love green beans. And then they never go far from their holes, because they know when danger comes, they've got to hightail it back underground, and they do so quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And around now, you should be seeing some of the babies. They're in the burrow, and then they eventually appear and start learning how to eat, what to eat, and what predators are, and how to run from them. Mm-hmm. So this time of year, people are enjoying seeing entire families. But the one thing they're not enjoying, of course, is damage to garden vegetables, like it's named, the beans, which is a favorite. It's a delicacy.
Well, Laura, do they have any kind of redeeming social value whatsoever?
I think they are wonderful creatures, and they're just so benign and harmless in every other way, and they're fun to watch, and it's fun to watch them communicate with their young. And so I think just being the creatures that they are, they have a lot of value. And the nice thing is we can work with them. I mean, we've devised a nice barrier system to protect gardens so mm-hmm. that we can have our vegetables and the woodchucks, too,
right?
And avoid that conflict. I think people tend to really hate them when they have a conflict, and as soon as you resolve the conflict, then you're free to like them and enjoy them, and that's what we try to go after.
I've got relatives like that.
Yeah. Well, no,
you said it perfectly. And me too.
You make a very good point. It's not necessarily the animal. It's the conflict that arises from time to time when humans and animals come into contact.
Exactly. And these are suburban creatures. These are not deep wood creatures. So, of course, they find the habitat in and around our homes just perfect, because what did we do? We put in all these delicacies. We put in garden vegetables. We put in all these great-tasting flowers. So we literally attract them to our mm-hmm. backyards, and then we get mad that they're there. But they really have no other place to go, because we've been converting a lot of farmland and old fields, and even horse pastures are diminishing. So, you know, the suburban backyard is the new stomping ground for woodchucks, mm-hmm. and that's where you tend to find them. And the biggest fear people have is when they're under their homes, and they come out, people see them, and because they're a relatively large rodent, mm-hmm. people think, oh my goodness, they're going to go after my children, just because they're a big creature.
Oh,
and they
God.
Are shocked to find out. These are vegetarians, and many daycare centers around the country make a game out of having the kids chase the woodchucks, because they're big scaredy cats. They run.
Oh,
if you come near them, they're going to fly into their uh-huh. burrow. They don't want anything to do with people or children, uh-huh. you know, and they don't go after them. We're not a prey item for woodchucks.
So they're completely vegetarian. Do they eat, like, insects and other things, or do they really just eat vegetable-y things?
Mainly just vegetable-y and plant things. Certainly an occasional insect when they're eating some of the vegetation, but that's not what they're looking for.
Okay.
And so that's nice. What I tell people is treat them just like the squirrels in your backyard.
Sure.
Huh. They're just as harmless.
Now, does the whole Punxsutawney Phil seeing a shadow thing help their PR image a little bit, do you think?
I think it helps their PR image for a day or two,
yeah.
and then people go back and
they
find
forget.
Some flowers chomped mm-hmm. or garden vegetables, and later on in the season, and that good feeling they have towards woodchucks goes away rather quickly.
So, Laura, do they really hibernate in the wintertime?
What they do, they do, and their heartbeat slows down so dramatically. I mean, they literally sleep out the entire winter. You cannot disturb them, and they're one of our few mm-hmm. true hibernators.
Huh.
And, you know, they you can't disturb a woodchuck till the spring, because they're barely alive when they are in hibernation. I mean, everything slows down to the point of, you know, you would wonder if they're still alive.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of their activities, you had mentioned, you know, we're likely to see them during the day, but are they, in fact, more active during the day or in the evening or in the nighttime?
They're very active by day, and dawn and dusk are big times to see woodchucks, but right in the middle of the afternoon is as well. They sleep at night.
Okay.
You won't see them at night.
Okay, so I can't blame them for eating the things that disappear overnight.
No, you have to blame somebody else.
Okay,
and
gotcha.
Maybe deer.
That's fair.
I
got an 8-foot fence.
Now have some competition from gray squirrels who are increasingly going after garden vegetables and flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And whether this is a adaptive thing, you know, we don't know, but there are some creatures you wouldn't suspect.
Mm-hmm.
But when people see a woodchuck and then experience damage, they always assume the woodchuck is wholly responsible, and that's not necessarily the case, particularly, as you mentioned, when there's nighttime damage and nobody sees who's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how long are their burrows, and are they social creatures with other woodchucks?
They are very social. They raise families, and usually in this part of the country, they will tolerate the presence of others. They're not like some of the ground squirrels or prairie dogs, which have huge colonies. Generally, you find one woodchuck family in a given area. But they can have a fairly large litter, up to six, and generally you'll see family units on the landscape, but not one big colony.
Mm-hmm. How long is the burrow that they dig?
It varies. I mean, some burrows are quite extensive, some are quite short. It all depends on what their need is. But they aren't deep burrowers, which many people fear, that the burrows will undermine structures. Mm-hmm. They don't.
Okay.
They really are generally shallow enough. And once a woodchuck has the chambers they need, they even have a separate toilet chamber,
cool.
which when it gets too full, they seal it off. Very, very neat, very
wow.
tidy.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a chamber for the young and several others, sort of other underground rooms of a house underneath mm-hmm. your shed or deck.
Kind of makes
but
you appreciate them more.
We're not seeing structural damage from uh-huh. woodchucks by and large.
Okay, so I'm starting to like... What did we name my
woodchuck?
Bob, do you remember?
Was it Woody or something? It was a little better than that.
I think it was a little better than that.
Yeah, it was better than Woody.
But the groundhog that... Oh, shoot, yeah. I wish I could remember what it was. The groundhog that lives in my barn.
Oh.
But now we, in fact, have one that's living in the side of the dam. So we do need to encourage him to move elsewhere because he could make the dam leak, right?
Okay, now you're talking about a woodchuck or a beaver?
A woodchuck.
Okay.
Living in an old fox den, basically,
oh,
I believe,
okay.
in the side of the
yeah,
dam.
For some reason, I thought you meant near the water.
Yeah.
Because people often confuse beavers and
right.
woodchucks. And the tail is very telling, and
sure.
they occupy different habitats.
Uh-huh.
The beavers are more water-based. But to get a woodchuck out, you want to create what's called a landscape of fear
okay.
and harassment. You want to convince this animal your predators are everywhere, this is a scary place, it's time to move on.
Okay.
And some successful strategies are just, one is general harassment. Take some apple cider vinegar, dunk some rags in it, and put them in baggies and punch holes in the baggies and throw them in the burrow
mm-hmm.
and then keep refilling the burrow in every day. Just fill it back in with dirt. And the woodchuck will get tired of having to redig out. Plus, they won't like the smell of the apple cider vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strong. You know, these animals want a very nice-smelling, sort of undisturbed place to raise their young. And if you keep harassing them by creating bad smells and filling in their holes every day, for about a week or so, they won't like it. And they generally tend to move their young out and to another burrow system. They'll create another one. It's extra work for them. But if they get scared enough, that's what they'll do.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have also had luck throwing down their burrows the urinated part of kitty litter. If you've got an indoor cat,
sure.
you can put that down the burrow and keep refilling it in with dirt. And again, that somehow creates a sense of a predator being around. They
uh-huh.
can smell the sulfuric stench,
cat
and
pee.
It may give them
yeah.
a sense of carnage,
right.
of
That's
a predator.
Bad. I'd get out, too. So, Laura, you know, the whole point is that we humanely deter animals from certain areas or try to get them to move. How do we make sure, as, you know, we put the kitty litter and the cider rags in the hole and fill it back, how do we make sure that we're not actually, like, sealing the groundhog in its hole or killing its babies by filling the hole back up?
It's a great question, and the reason is the cider vinegar smells, but it's not harmful.
Mm-hmm.
We used to recommend ammonia, but now we're convinced that is harmful.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, when you refill the holes with dirt, they can dig out.
Okay.
I mean, we've had people pour gasoline and cement and all kinds of crazy things down burrows that doesn't work and is actually dangerous and harmful for the animals. But
sure.
just refilling it with dirt and putting in the odor of apple cider vinegar, neither of those are going to be harmful or create a situation where the woodchuck can't dig out.
Okay.
But then they just go to somebody else's yard.
Well, you know, this is their habitat where they are, and you can't control everything.
Yeah.
They may go to somebody else's yard. They may go someplace where they're not minded. But, you know, if you need them out of your yard, that's really, mm-hmm. we feel, the best strategy is to evict them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they'll go to whatever part of their right. habitat they were probably in before.
They'll have to buy suitcases, the poor
yeah.
things.
Well, see, that's
exactly.
the thing. I don't mind them anywhere, but we don't really want them in the
yeah.
side of the earthen part of the dam because it,
right.
you know, isn't healthy for the rest of that particular system.
Right.
So,
and one other thing you can mm-hmm. do, which I didn't mention, is
sure.
that big eyes create a predator image for a lot of animals. And some people have
okay.
lined areas with Mylar balloons, the mm-hmm. ones that have big faces.
Right, the birds.
And big eyes, yes. And they you set them about 3 feet off the ground around the opening to a woodchuck burrow, mm-hmm. and it's very freaky for the woodchuck when they come and go to have these bobbing balloons with big eyes, and that in itself has been enough to get them to self-evict.
But then they need counseling.
Self-evict. I like that. So, Laura, August is the time of the year that the Humane Society of the United States is encouraging people to try some of these strategies, these eviction
right.
strategies. Mm-hmm. Is that because they're basically in late by late August, they're finished raising their families and the little ones have kind of gone off on their own?
Exactly. And usually by September, as it gets colder, then woodchucks start thinking about going into hibernation. But by the end of summer, the babies are dispersing or they are big enough to be booted out with the parents and go mm-hmm. someplace else.
All right. You guys on your website have some scenarios, too, in terms of the most stubborn of creatures that are hard to evict. So there's all kinds of ideas, you know, to just be persistent. But you also have somewhat of a system. I have an 8-foot fence around my vegetable garden, but a lot of people, you know, have smaller gardens. They don't need anything like that. Are there ways in which to deter groundhogs from feeding in, you know, small garden plots that
yes.
you guys have come up with?
Yes. The best solution and the cheapest we've come up with is based on the green garden fencing or even chicken wire.
Mm-hmm.
And you buy a 4-foot roll, and what you create, you trick the woodchuck in two ways. You make an L-shaped barrier, so the top 3 feet of the fence comes out of the ground, and the bottom foot goes in an L-shape facing away from the garden about a foot along the ground.
Okay.
And you secure it to the ground with landscaping staples. And the reason for this is you create a false bottom. So when the woodchuck comes up to your fence to try and dig under it,
he
starts to dig and he hits mesh.
Okay.
And in his mind, oh, this is, you know, can't go any farther. It doesn't occur to him to back up a foot mm-hmm. and start digging there.
Okay.
And for the top portion of the barrier, we recommend that you leave the top 3 feet wobbly. When you stake it to your metal stakes or wooden stakes,
mm-hmm.
don't pull it taut. Let it be wobbly because woodchucks can climb, but they don't like climbing things that are wobbly.
Mm-hmm.
So after he tries to dig under your garden and can't because of your false bottom, then he'll go up and try and climb your barrier. And if it wobbles, he'll get discouraged and realize, I'm not getting in here.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, these are the two tricks we build into creating a woodchuck-proof barrier, and they work really well. And I test everything in my own garden, and I have a woodchuck family that I think has been angry at me for years, but they're happy in our yard, and we have our garden, and they absolutely don't get in.
Uh-huh.
And I watch them coming up to the barrier every now and then, testing it, and giving up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to feel sorry for woodchucks.
Well, that's our goal. I think we've achieved it now.
We
do have some people who like them so much that they leave out apples.
Mm-hmm.
After they put in a barrier, they leave out a little bit of food, I think, because they feel guilty. But, you know, if you have a nice lawn, that's all they need. They're happy. They don't really need your garden.
All right. Those are some great tips, Laura. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for allowing me to be a guest on the show.
Uh-huh. Laura Simon spoke to us from the Connecticut Field Office, where she's the director of the Urban Wildlife Program with the Humane Society of the United States. Their mission is to promote non-lethal means to resolve conflicts between people and wildlife. For more information on the Humane Society of the United States and their program book, Wild Neighbors, The Humane Approach to Living with Wildlife, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we head to Old Louisville for a tour of two local gardens. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And Miss Wishy, about a month ago or so, I was on the Old Louisville garden tour. I was really enchanted by a garden I saw at the corner of Magnolia and Levering. It was had a nice picket fence around it and just had a little bit of everything. It had peach trees and cherry trees, a nice vegetable garden, a real mix of beautiful flowers, and obviously done by people who cared. So we're back here to talk to them, and their names are Wayne, Bruce, and Bess Kiesling. It's a family. It's a couple and their son who Bruce did some of the design, and then the rest of the family put the thing together, and we're here to talk to them. So what do you think?
I think it's great. It's like one of those little treasures you come around a corner, and it's something kind of out of place,
yeah.
You know? Wayne, how long have you guys lived here?
We lived here, we have 3 years in next month.
Okay, and I take it that Bruce, your son, who's lived here a little bit longer, has sort of tempted you with grandchildren and other promises of great gardening in Louisville. Is that true?
That is true.
All right. So your son is here as well. Bruce, tell us a little bit about the concept of, I guess, Old Louisville. It was something that you remarked on, the importance of sort of living in a historic neighborhood, the importance of continuing to incorporate gardening in your all's lives, because it's something that's always been there. But what's your philosophy in terms of living in the city?
My wife and I, for vocational reasons, live in the city, and it just makes sense for our lives as a family. My wife works part-time, I work full-time. We homeschool our children, but we also wanted to give them an opportunity to be near their grandparents and to have some of the outdoor gardening experiences I did growing up.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have that necessarily in your own Old Louisville backyard, very small, but when your folks moved here and they had this nice little, you know, plot next to their houses, the idea starts to emerge, and thus the collective family garden here. So talk about the concept of how you wanted this to develop, and surely how you want it to continue to develop.
Well, for me, it is in part being able to produce something edible. You know, I see gardens today where there's so much that is ornamental, which is great and beautiful, but I grew up where there was a garden that was productive. And, you know, I live over on Belgravia Court, that's about a block away, and literally have no yard. And this came available, and it seemed like the perfect place to do an urban garden mm-hmm. that would be productive and potentially ornamental as well.
Well, Bruce, the phrase you used, a wonderful phrase, was you were the inspiration and your dad was the perspiration.
Right.
So let's talk to your dad about that. Where'd the perspiration start begin here?
It starts with digging and spading it all by hand, putting in the soil that you want, organic soil on top of it and so on. I don't like to use anything commercial as far as for if I don't have to, and I have not here, except for a product that you would liquid fertilizer, but other than that, I haven't. So there's a lot of work into doing that, and because the soil is hard, and we're working on obviously getting compost and things in it that will make it more, you know, tillable. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to spade when it's hot.
And if I could just add to that, there was actually a house that was on this ground. I don't know when it was torn down, but this is, again, a historic neighborhood. The house was torn down, and this lot got joined to the house. So unfortunately, they trucked in just about 3 or 4 years ago a bunch of topsoil, and underneath this, there's a lot of rubble.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when my father talks about spading, just getting the soil to be workable mm-hmm. and productive mm-hmm. has been some work.
Well, let's talk about what's actually here. We've talked about how, and certainly there's ornamental, there's a great picket fence around the plot. Roses, clematis, looks like some hyacinth bean, a couple of peach trees that are absolutely the most beautiful peaches I have seen. I'm extremely jealous because
there's going to be a peach short here before this show's over.
Daddy's peaches never looked like that, Bob.
No,
a couple of cherry
mine.
Trees, and, you know, interest in adding some more of that. And then also some small little potager kitchen raised beds that are part of the kitchen garden, tomatoes, lettuces, some herbs, some beans, strawberries,
peppers, sweet corn,
peppers, yeah, all kinds of good stuff. You were talking, Bruce, about the fact that there was a house here. Is that one of the reasons you all chose to have raised beds for the fruit? Did you have to have the soil tested? Were there any concerns in terms of contamination or toxicity?
Well, we probably should have done all of those things, but we did not. There was a previous owner who had done one part of the raised bed, mm-hmm. and basically I felt like something is going to grow here, and we should have done all that testing, but we didn't. But in mm-hmm. part, the raised beds, particularly for the vegetables, are because the quality of the soil is just not good. The growth of the fruit trees has been actually a surprise to us as well.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
They're doing so well.
So do you spray them, or is there any sort of maintenance involved at this point? Lucky?
Yeah, the only spray that I put on was the spring, a dormant spray.
Okay.
All right? And other than that, I have not sprayed them for disease Excellent. Or bugs or anything. Now, you will notice, to be fair to the listeners, there's a little curl on the peach trees.
Uh-huh.
And when I noticed that this spring, I first read what I had for spray, and they said that that should have been put on last fall to take care of that, which I did not realize. But I also called the company where we bought them from to check with them, and they likewise told me it should have been done in the fall, and so I missed that, but hopefully we'll have to do it this fall. But other than that, there's nothing.
They still look beautiful. And you've selected a variety that's columnar in shape so that it suits this particular landscape a little bit better. It's not going to take up as much space. Also, is it honestly a great sort of offset to the telephone pole that's behind it. So there's some design elements there as well. Yes,
that was Bruce's choice.
The telephone pole peach is perfect. Yeah, Wayne, we did a show a month or so ago on heirloom tomatoes, and lo and behold, I turn around and look, and you've got a half a dozen right here. Talk about those and how well they've done for you.
I'm going to turn that over to Bruce. He picked the heirloom tomatoes, and they're doing well, but he can talk about his choice.
Well, my wife and I both appreciate the variety, and I think that's another reason why we have this garden, because you can't get the heirloom tomatoes at Kroger. And I grew up being able to walk outdoors and see this kind of thing growing. So we're thrilled with the heirloom tomatoes. This is the first year, actually, for these beds and to have these. And I think they're doing so well. What my father isn't saying is that he's literally out here all afternoon and all evening watering, pinching off bugs, etc. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of TLC.
And it shows.
So what are some future plans now? We've had a really good season. That sort of, what's your appetite, I think, sometimes to do more when the last 2 years, probably the 2 years that you were really perspiring and getting things ready, were terrible growing seasons. So an easy growing season, everything's looking good. What's the next step in terms of expanding the garden?
Well, I think what I would like to see is the development of a mature herb bed and expanding probably the variety of tomatoes and other things. So in terms of space, we're not going to expand productive space, but we are going to probably add more variety.
And are you going to use a shovel this time or leave your dad to do that?
Well, I do help with the shoveling, but the watering and tending is all my dad.
All right.
Well, this is
and
not
you get
a word.
Eat too, right? Yeah. The eating.
Yes. This is not a word I use loosely. This place is an inspiration, I think, to gardeners who really want to start and see what can be done. We've been talking with Wayne and Bruce Kiesling for the garden at the corner of Magnolia and Levering. It's a cottage garden, a historic garden, just a great place, and we appreciate you guys spending the time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You can see it from the street, but just don't pick the peaches, right?
All right.
And for pictures of the Kiesling's garden, go to the homegrown page at wfpl.org. Well, Miss Wishy, continuing our old Louisville tour, we've wandered over to 6th Street to the home of Howard Rosenberg and Gina Blythe. It's a totally different look, a totally different feel, sort of a New Orleans style, you might say.
You might say, and they were gracious enough to allow me to take a pit stop on the way to the garden, and their bathroom is like totally dedicated to New Orleans. You can tell that you've got some history in New Orleans or interest in New Orleans, because the garden, in fact, courtyard garden, typical of old Louisville,
yes,
but also typical of New Orleans style gardens as well. Gina, you've lived here for some 11 years or so, right?
9 years.
So when you first came into this home and into this courtyard, what was here and how much work has been done to transform it into what we see today?
Well, the backyard was very generic, covered in redwood decking. It reminded me of something you might see in a newer suburb with the decking and the porch and the barbecue. I didn't think that looked fit in old Louisville, so I got a Wonder Bar and a girlfriend, and we went to work. And we got rid of all the wood, had it replaced with brick, and put in a pond, and got rid of the generic bushes, and put in little gardens, and made it look the way I wanted it to look like old Louisville.
All right. And then you married this character over here and he moved in. Certainly there's some sort of collaboration in the garden and philosophy in terms of the way that you all want to use it together. How do you feel about the space?
Well, I really like the space. I mean, even if you look inside the house, what Gina will say is when I moved in, all her furniture went in the basement. But we carried over outside what we tried inside, which was really to take her taste, which tended to be more contemporary, mine was more traditional, and blend them. But in the garden, what we really began to, in the courtyard, really began to try to do was to not, to recreate what we had seen in New Orleans, which was you behind these massive houses, you'd look in and you'd see these fountains and these gardens. So we just started taking the space and trying to create a space that reminded us of New Orleans, a place that we visit, you know, frequently throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And that's how we constructed it.
Mm-hmm. And Howard, what caught my ear when I was here for the old Louisville tour was you have music out here. You have speakers hidden around and they're playing classical music now, a little Verdi maybe, but you could also be having Louis Armstrong here if you'd like.
We have an eclectic taste in music. At least I do. Gina doesn't like my music. I don't like hers. But most of the music I'm playing outside, which is El Divo, she doesn't like. But, you know, I just saw these speakers. I saw some speakers at I don't know if it was Big Lots or Value City, and just bought them and then tried to figure out how I could hide the wires. But it also creates a space out here that you can sit, relax, listen to music, and just kind of, it's really neat to hear the traffic going on, the planes going overhead, and then to be sitting here relaxing, having dinner or over a cocktail, listening to classical music or whatever you know suits your fancy.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things too about the garden, I think, is you've been able to make sure you're getting a little bit of everything that you want, and you know that's difficult in these typically shady courtyard gardens. But you've figured out where you get the most sun for the longest period of time during the day. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of the progression of the garden and the plants you choose to suit those needs, and obviously to suit, you know, how you want to use them as well? Because I see that you've got quite a few edibles, et cetera.
Right. Howard and I both love to cook. I love to can. Mm-hmm. If you'll notice in the kitchen, I've already made some pickles and peach preserves. I love to make herbed vinegars and oils, so that's what I do with most of my herbs, although we'll be in the middle of preparing dinner and run out and grab a bunch of basil or a bunch of rosemary and use it. It's wonderful to have those available. Mm-hmm. And the flowers back here, all the sunflowers as I call them, most of those came from family members that are no longer with us. Mm-hmm. And so they're really even more special. My mom's phlox are back there, my Aunt Jenny's 4 o'clocks. Mm-hmm. So the garden represents a lot of gardens from the past. I even have one lily that blooms in August that my mom brought from her farm in the 30s to her house. Mm-hmm. And when she passed away, I brought it here to my house. So I've got a lot of things that are really special in that way. And I think I like the old-timey flowers in old Louisville. Somebody on the garden tour asked me what a 4 o'clock was and said they never heard of that flower. And I can remember them growing all along our house growing up. And we used to use the black hard seeds in pea shooters. And so there's some great memories from some of the flowers I've got.
You need to clarify, Aunt Jenny's not dead.
Oh, yeah.
She's
90.
Okay.
She's 90 years old.
She's just sharing her plants with you. It's not a done deal.
Yeah, to give our listeners a sense of this place, it's about a 20 by 24 foot room with a 3-story brick building on one side and a wonderful old Louisville fence on another side, and of course the garage backing up to it. And then the sun garden she alluded to is like a long hallway that goes off the side, and that's where the sun hits the plants that need the most sun. But above us, just a lovely weeping cherry tree that creates an umbrella over this whole place. Tell us about that.
I had the weeping cherry tree put in probably right after I moved here, about 8 years ago. And it was not much bigger than you are. And it's really grown.
I resent that.
It's really grown. And it never bloomed very much. I'd have a bloom here, a bloom there, scattered throughout the tree. But this spring, the entire tree bloomed. It was the most beautiful thing I think I'd ever seen. I tried to get pictures of it, but it didn't do it justice.
Mm-hmm. The front yard is welcoming as well. We've been, you know, kind of we've stationed ourselves here in the back, which is your private domain. But the front yard is a very welcoming sight. Was that something you had talked earlier about, trying to get out some very old, neglected, burning bushes, which kind of separated you from this old Louisville that you love?
What we tried to do, as I said, I came home one day and all this 15 to 20 foot burning bush had been cut down that was all along the front sidewalk. And then we took the rest of it down. It just opened the place up. We wanted to be able to even, you know, we just purchased a swing that we're going to put in the front yard. We want to be able to enjoy the front yard also, because I like sitting on the front porch and just watching the neighborhood. Place across the street has music on the weekends. We can sit and watch that going on, or we can connect with neighbors. And so, you know, there's a sense when the bushes came down that we may have lost some privacy. But on the other hand, it's really neat to watch this neighborhood and watch people moving about. It's a really diverse neighborhood. It's very eclectic. So you get the opportunity with this what I think is a beautiful front yard, to watch all this urban stuff and sprawl going on around you.
It's a great garden. It's clear that the gardeners in Old Louisville have a really strong commitment to the history of Old Louisville, but also continuing to make sure that it represents itself well. Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Howard Rosenberg and Gina Blythe have created a New Orleans-style garden behind their New Orleans-style house. For photographs of the house, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here, and we've got four great questions, three which Janine will answer because I don't know anything about them.
Because they're veggies, sort of related ones.
I eat veggies, so I don't...
Yeah.
I raise them, but not...
If they fail, you just turn the other
cheek.
It's not my
fault. Yeah. I've never had a plant die that was my fault.
I'll bring some in for you instead.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, here's the squash question. It's from Kim. My squash plants bloom, and there's big yellow blooms all over them, but then they shrivel. She says she has 15 blooms on one plant, and I know they're all going to die. Is there anything I can do? My aunt said I was lacking ash in my soil. Any advice would be appreciated. Do nothing. Here's the thing, and it same thing goes with a lot of the...
Melon types of plants,
exactly. Cucumbers, squash, etc. The first blooms are male blooms.
Oh.
It's a way in which to ensure that when the female blooms do bloom, right, that there's some male pollen there that gets transferred to
I didn't know that.
Yes. So your very first blooms, likely, Kim, this is the first flush of blooms that are coming on for your squash plants. The first blooms... Same thing with cucumbers. I had a couple of people ask me about their cucumbers this spring. In fact, I was thinking it myself. When am I going to get some cucumbers? First blooms are always male blooms.
Well, you need the guys around for something.
Absolutely, you do.
But then,
and they come first.
And they go first, too.
So don't worry. You are going to get some fruit. Your female blooms will start to bloom soon. All right, Bob, here's one that's up your alley for sure. This one's from Tanya. My husband and I live in the Highlands, and we would love to start a European beech hedge in front of our house, like those hedges you have in Holland and England. Do you think it's possible to do that in Louisville? And if so, where can we buy the plants? She's looked at several catalogs, but she hasn't seen any European beeches.
This question made me so happy. Now, I've not done it with beeches, and it's easier to do it with a European hornbeam.
Which looks very, very, very,
very
similar.
Very similar. It's easier to find, easier to grow. And I saw those same hedges in England and Ireland and Scotland. I loved them. About 6 years ago, I planted some little bitty hornbeams, maybe 18 inches tall, 3 feet apart, 2.5 feet apart, and I let them grow and pruned them, and now, for the first time this year in 6 years, I've got a 10-foot hedge, perfectly squared off at the edges.
Yeah.
And there's a hole in the middle, a doorway.
Because Tony and Shelley Knoll did the same thing. Yeah. The owners of the Plant Kingdom did the same thing in their backyard along a fence, and it was just this beautiful screen.
It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, so Hornbeam.
Hornbeam, and you can find them and go to a wholesale dealer, and you're going to need 15 or 20 at least, 25 to make it work. But the retailers will be way too expensive. Find a wholesale wholesale dealer that sells Hornbeam bare root stock, order it in the spring, and you'll love it.
Yeah.
You'll just love it.
Good
it's
idea.
It's just very satisfying.
Good idea. All right, here's another vegetable fruit question, Bob. This one's from Sherry. She said her grapes are in abundance this year. However, each cluster has several grapes that have turned a dark color and shriveled up. What could be causing this?
Wine?
And yeah, that was black rot, basically, okay. Or like mummy berry sort of concept, but black rot. Grapes are very susceptible to fungal problems and bacterial problems, and if you don't use a fungicide early in the season, as soon as the grapes leaf out, you have typically a problem like this, either spots on the foliage or, you know, fruit that turns black and rots, right? So it's too late now really to do anything. And the fact that it was such a rainy season, Bob, I would think that there's going to be a higher incidence and disease with grapes. She also wants to know, she has a blackberry patch that's yielding in abundance. Her question is, does she prune back the new growth or prune back the vines that produce berries?
There you go.
And then she's also wondering, she thinks that blackberries need muir acid, and is that correct? No, it's not. They don't need muir acid. They don't need particularly acid soil, so I wouldn't worry about that at this point. You can fertilize next early spring. But the part that you want to cut back is the old growth.
Right.
So all the canes that fruited in abundance this year are the canes you remove, because all that stuff that's growing up new this year is going to bear your fruit next year.
That I knew I wanted to make you feel better.
Yes. When, of course you know that.
I know
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Okay, one more, Bob.
Okay, Miss Wishy, for you again. Wayne W. I have a plant in my yard, and it has leaves of its shape like a heart, and the trunk of this plant is green, has several yellow blooms on it. It's about 6 feet tall. I have no idea what it is. Hoping you can help me. Thank you.
Sounds like a perfect description of what we call Indian mallow.
Yeah.
It's a weed, you know. They also call it, Bob, you've seen it. They also call it velvet leaf.
Yep.
Because the leaves are kind of velvety, real soft, big heart shape, big thick stalk. And then mallow, Indian mallow, common name.
Yeah.
You know, the mallow-like yellow blooms hang underneath, you know, close to the stem. So.
And it will reseed like crazy, as Wayne said, so you have to be careful with it.
Yeah, and it's a weed, so I would whack it down if you can. Otherwise, it can be a little bit of a pain in the you-know-what. So
yeah, I've been there.
It's a type of a butylon, basically.
Okay.
All right.
If you have some more questions for Janine, and maybe Bob, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, this Latin word of the week reminds me of how I used to feel in the old days on Sunday mornings after too many time in the pub.
Too much time in the pub, huh? All right.
Yep.
Well, the Latin word of the week this week, this is sort of how my hair looks these days.
I wish I
is
could.
Is divaricata, divaricatus, divaricatum, or catum, I guess.
Yep.
But divaricata. It means spreading, growing in a straggling manner.
I got to get drunk, and I sure do dread it. It was my song for a long time.
So, for example, Aster divaricatus.
The white wood aster. That plant.
I totally love that plant.
Yeah.
And it does kind of grow in a straggling manner.
Yeah, it does.
But almost kind of neat straggling manner.
Yeah.
But something else, too, that I think, at least with some of these plants, not all of them, they're woodland plants as well. And sometimes if you're a woodland plant, you're going to be a little more straggling because you're in the shade.
Well, it's lovably straggling.
Do you know what I mean? Exactly. Yeah. Adenophora divaricata.
Ladybells.
Ladybells, which actually is kind of scraggly.
Yeah.
Campanula divaricata.
The small bonny bellflower.
That's got to be like from Scotland
Ireland.
Or Ireland
it's
or something.
It's got to be,
Small bonny bellflower. It's a little scraggling. Phlox divaricatus.
Another favorite, wild blue phlox.
Yes.
Beautiful
that's a fabulous plant.
Yep.
Geranium divaricatum.
Hardy geraniums.
It's a hardy geranium species that is a little on the scraggly side.
Well,
so.
You got some winners here, though.
Helianthus divaricatus.
The woodland sunflower.
What, did you know there was a woodland sunflower?
No.
I didn't either.
It sounds...
Sounds delightful and scraggly.
Yeah.
Serpus, do you think that's how you say it? S-C-I-R-P-U-S? Serpus?
Close enough.
Serpus divaricatus.
The spreading bulrush.
Spreading bulrush.
That sounds biblical.
It does sound biblical, and it's probably a little scraggling in nature. So,
If
you see divaricata, divaricatus, or divaricatum, the plant is spreading or growing in a straggling manner, which may appeal to some people, but may not appeal to all.
And give it a ride home if it needs it, will you?
There you go. All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us next week for another show.
Homegrown is produced by the always solid Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.